Hello, it's great to have you with me. I'm Kim Clyden, former ABC radio presenter and children's book author, creating a community of people who care about children. How do we nurture creative, connected, resilient, emotionally intelligent, and empowered children? And they say it takes a village. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility, you're not alone. We're surrounded, though, by people who can support us, your family, friends, and professionals, who all play an influential role in shaping our children. Imagine if your parents, teachers, relatives, or carers told you another story. Your life story would be completely different. I believe we can change the narrative for our children, but to do that, we need to change our story. With a big shift towards getting kids to move and play, it's never been more important to get our kids active. Play is not just about fun. According to my guest today, it's a fundamental right. I often hear adults and parents alike lamenting the loss of the carefree childhoods of the 70s and 80s. Something I remember when we'd ride our push bikes until dusk, hike the hills exploring caves, play cricket in the street, and even walk to the corner store to buy an ice block in summer, alone. What's changed? We often don't know our neighbours. Many even live in fear of the worst things that could happen. And we seem to be losing the ability to connect with our community. As CEO of the Australian Institute of Play, Hayano Moser is a childhood advocate, community builder, and outdoor educator. As a father of four boys, he's dedicated more than 20 years to supporting children, connecting them with nature and each other, with freedom and fun, challenge and mastery, a belief and view his own childhood experience contributed to, ultimately creating a turning point when he chose a new name and a new path for his life. I spoke with him on site at Jumanji Land, a free community adventure playground in Brisbane, Australia. Hayano, thank you so much for joining me to share your story. How did your tumultuous childhood impact your life?
Oh, yeah, well, I was a street kid. You know, I grew up on the streets of Adelaide, left home when I was 14 because my home life wasn't all that great. And I suppose it took me until I was about 18 to realize I could make different choices, and then probably about 3 years of transitioning out of that lifestyle of no one trusting me and making bad choices and not really thinking about anybody else except for myself. And when I was 20, my son was born, our first son was born, and that was really the driver for it all. I realized I had to be responsible for somebody else, and that really making decent steps with turning my life around for his benefit.
What kind of transformation are we talking about? I mean, what area of your life really needed to be addressed now that you were a parent?
Personal responsibility, mostly. Just being responsible for my actions. You know, like I think I had a big chip on my shoulder. And I felt like the world owed me, and it didn't. And it took me a long time to figure out that anything, if I wanted to make changes in the life, I needed to start with me first and take responsibility for everything that was around my life. And then I realized once I took responsibility for my actions, then I can then set the directions of my life. And that was a freeing realization. From there, I started setting goals, and I fell in love with goal setting, actually. I still have lots of goals. Some are a bit more loftier and bigger these days, and once I started taking personal responsibility, that really was the catalyst for the big changes in my life and turning things around for myself and my son and my family where it is now.
From homelessness to fatherhood and goal setting, how did you forge a path into advocating for children?
Yeah, great question. So and part of that healing process, I suppose, was I went on an outdoor education camp when I was 19. As part of a youth camp, you know, with some youth workers that were trying to help us get off the streets and do something positive and constructive with our lives. And they were brilliant, these youth workers, but they took us on this camp to a place called Mibumbia, which is a Yugambeh word for in the company of an eagle. And we did a lot of activities in the wilderness, doing adventure activities. And I love the positive risk taking that came along with that. And I really, that's, I suppose, where I learned to set small goals and celebrate the small wins, and then they can lead to big wins. I think once I got past that, I realized that was something I love, being in nature, and I love challenging myself. I've watched all of my friends who are in that camp also get so much out of it. And I thought, I want to do that as a job, you know, and really help young people. And so I did. I went and I got a degree in leisure management and majored in outdoor recreation. And so, yeah, I went to university after never even finishing high school, didn't do finish year nine. And that was a big learning, steep learning curve. And then that's where I realized my brain was quite a good one. And then, I got into outdoor education, you know, spent my time supporting young people to grow as human beings, challenge themselves, value challenge, and value connection, and treating each other with respect and kindness. And from there, after a few of my children were born, I realized I couldn't do the outdoor education job forever, because sleeping out in the bush with children, you know, for weeks on end, takes me away from my family. And so I landed a job running an organization called Nature Play Queensland, and that advocated for kids' outdoor play. And that seemed like quite an easy transition. For me, that was a realization, because that was in 2014, and we're talking probably 4 years, 5 years after the smartphone really took off. The social changes, we were starting to see all the social changes in our young people really starting to shine. I understood that kids were playing outside less, and a lot of that reduction and decline of children playing outside was to do with the decisions adults were making, because adults are the biggest barriers to kids' play. The restrictions of children's play has been largely out of love, but it's come at a greater cost. My job since then has been helping adults negotiate those barriers and create and carve out opportunities for children to engage in real play, child-led directed play. Like when I talk about play, play is intrinsically motivating. Kids do it because they want to. Self-directed, they're the ones leading it. They are autonomous. They don't need adults to do it. And it's freely chosen. They choose it. So that's the psychological definition of play. And so that's the play that I espouse. So now, and I spend my time creating places like this, like Jumanji Land, you know, this incredible, we call it a neighborhood backyard. So it's immersed in a community. It's staffed with people from the community who we train in play work. And they every afternoon after school, the gates are opened and the local children come in and play and connect with each other, and families feel grateful that they have somewhere safe and supervised, that their kids can come and play and get involved in risky play and connect and build friendships. And yeah, it's an incredibly joyous, wholesome, rewarding place. You know, it's fantastic. So yeah, that's the story in a nutshell, I suppose. Yeah.
When you've talked about the fact that people have turned to devices and they're indoors a lot more, you've also highlighted at the end there some of the reasons through society it's become more risky and less safe to be outdoors, particularly alone or unsupervised for children. How much do you think the changes in our society have really steered a lot of that capacity of people to be free on the streets anymore?
Yeah, it's had a, I think at the heart of it, the crux of it all, over the last 20 to 30 years, what we've seen is a breakdown in human solidarity. We don't know each other. We don't spend a lot of time in our own communities. And because we don't know each other, we don't trust each other. There's all these question marks around the people who we live amongst. I read somewhere that the human can really only sustain a maximum of 150 people in their networks. That's quality sustained relationships. And I also read that somewhere, I can't remember where, I think it was Seth Kaplan's book actually, that post the 90s, the maximum average or the average network was about 13 people that we had in our orbit. Now mean, you know, some people think they've got 10,000 friends on Facebook or Instagram or whatever, and followers, and our networks are largely digitally driven. Giving that time in our own communities is the solution, actually. It's the solution to doing that. Well, we've done these things called neighborhood play networks where we go into a community, we find one family who want to reconnect all the kids in their community, in their street for play. And we help support that person to go around. And the first thing we got to do is we got to ask for permission. So we go around, we walk with this family up and down their street and knock on the doors and meet all their neighbors and tell them about our plan, that we're going to try to activate this street as a place for kids to play again. And everybody can identify with that, because most kids, most adults had that. There's a level of nostalgia that goes with it. You know, nostalgia is a great emotion because it's a very perplexing emotion, because it's both happy and sad. When we think back and things, we think, oh, I love that moment. And then there's a sadness that it's not around anymore. So most people in the streets can connect with that nostalgia of that loss of play in their communities. They wonder what kids are doing inside their houses all these days. I've never had anybody say, no, I'm not in favor of this. And then we help them organize weekly play activities in their streets, connect everybody, connect the parents. Everybody comes out, meets, gets to know each other. And the stories that come out of that are just gorgeous. Oh my God. Now, there's a 92-year-old who lived in this one street, Dorothy. She lived on her own. She lost her husband. She lost both her sons. And then not recently, she'd lost both her dogs. And some of the other neighbors were whinging about her because she likes to feed the pigeons. And the pigeons then come in swarms and they poo on everything. But once everybody came out and understood that Dorothy's only friends were the pigeons and that she had gone through significant loss and she was 92 and living on her own, that changed everybody's perceptions of this lady. She was no longer this annoying woman who feeds the pigeons. She's somebody who's got a story and an incredible story, and they get to be part of that now. And I mean, and that's the same for all the kids in the community who play up and down their street. They get to sleep at each other's houses and bounce from house to house every day and playing tag through the whole neighborhood, not just in their backyard. And there's a sense of trust. And these are in suburbs where most people wouldn't expect them, low socioeconomic areas, you know. So these people, I think in some regard, have an advantage in this area because they know how to lean on each other. Where people in middle and upper incomes, they've got the resources where they don't have to. They can outsource things. Yep. So it's that breakdown in solidarity that is really at the heart of the decline of play. Because when adults don't trust each other, they don't let their kids play.
Just recently, we've seen two young, vibrant men who are coming home from playing sport, and they've been attacked on a street in Australia, it just shocked me. They've lost their lives and they've been out playing. So, you know, how do we reconcile the world we live in with the values we hold so dear?
That's right. That's right. And, you know, one thing I take in to heart with some of these things is knowing your neighborhoods and your communities is safety. Those kids, that's, and what happened to them, it's called news for a reason, right? It's an exception. It doesn't happen very often. Nobody wants their kid to be the one, though, and I get that. But if you know your neighborhood and you know your community and you know the people in your community, then you'll have a greater sense of the safety that your children actually have in that space. You know, in my neighborhood where my kids go, we don't have a concern because we've got to know everyone. We know everybody in our area. So that's created safety as well. And then our kids are protected because they still get to go out and play and they don't have to sit down and have sedentary lives engaged with a screen. You know, they can go out and have these engaged, really rich, full lives. I think we've forgotten how much we got from those childhoods that we just took for granted would always be there.
You're a huge advocate for children's human rights. And as I understand from my research, freedom, agency and self-expression, which all come under play, how did your personal experience of the outdoor play and the benefits of what you've seen in your work help people understand what a child's human rights are?
Well, I mean, it's in the United Conventions on the Rights of a Child. Is Article 31 is children have the rights to play. And then there's Article, I think, 5, where children have the right to voice and expression. And children actually express themselves and speak through their play. If people spend a bit of time with kids and watch them at play, you get to learn a lot about what a child is up to in their life and in their developments and what's important to them as humans and even the directions that they're choosing to take themselves. It's pretty incredible. And then Article 14, or is it 12? I always get those ones mixed up, is children have the right to peaceful assembly, just like adults do. And that is the right to have a community and go out and play in your neighborhood. That's a peaceful assembly, you know. So, and it's the decline of these rights. You know, we've got a huge spike in children taking their own lives, and it's the highest rate of death is suicide for young people, and mental health crisis is getting, you know, and out of control, and it's gone up at the same rate as play declining. I mean, there's lots of you know, folks who say, well, there's no evidence to suggest that that's exactly what at the cause of it, and you know, that's because no one's done that research, not because it isn't true. There's no financial incentive for anybody to do that research. No, you know, there's a lot of financial incentive for people, for kids to stay engaged with technology. Not a lot of financial incentive, apart from a government perspective and a public health perspective, that the incentive is huge, and the benefits for the community would be massive. From a rights perspective, children have that right, but it's in decline. And Australia had signed up to the United Nations on the Rights of a Child Convention in 2009. And so, you know, as a signatory, you know, our country has a responsibility to do something about it. And, you know, governments will convince you that they are. And I agree, they're doing lots in many areas. But in the realm of play, there's not much being done at all. Collectives of organisations who are working on this, who feel just as passionate about it as I do, and they are working on it, and they see the decline, and they see the opportunities for children. And it's just navigating it, because, you know, a lot of the solutions that we come up with now are adult-led and adult-driven. That then goes back to the definition of play, which is self-directed, autonomous, intrinsically motivated, and freely chosen. If adults get involved with it, then, you know, have you actually lost the play element? So yeah. There's a conundrum there.
There's a photo on your profile on the Australian Institute of Play's website of you on a skateboard. I mean, obviously, yeah. It's important that as adults, we also maintain that connection to our inner child and remember how to play and have fun.
Definitely. Definitely. We can role model play for children, and they need it now, because there's been a decline in the benchmark. Like, kids look up and out and through into life. You know, they look up to the next child and they go, okay, what's the benchmark that you're going to set for me? It's great that adults role model it too, but it's even more powerful when it comes from children a little bit older than them, you know, just to show them what's next. And it's not too far away. When they look at me, I'm 50, you know, and go, okay, so when I'm 50, I'm going to be able to play. You know, it's, You know, if they look at they're 7 and they look at a 10-year-old, it's only 3 years away. It's not far away.
I've never thought about it like that, but it's very funny. The way I discovered you was through a post that you provided on an upcoming Childhood Summit 2025. Now, this blew my mind. I've never seen such a radical take on youth and childhood expression. All of the speakers are children. How on earth did this come about, especially as an event in the Brisbane region at Slacks Creek?
So the first event I held, the first Childhood Summit in 2019, was when I was running Nature Play Queensland. And we realised that to really address play on a systemic level, because the problems, you know, the breakdown in adult solidarity, the way we design our cities, you know, our education systems and the way they're declining play, the health system, and everything needed a bit of a rethink. And so we did that, and then we thought, oh, how about we bring kids in as well to tell us what they think, you know, because we're often speaking on behalf of children, but have we got it right? And so we thought, well, we'll put it out there and we'll ask kids what they think. And then that was a revolutionary moment when those young people brought their thoughts to the table at that 2019 summit. It was the highlight. There was four kids speaking. And I think we got to the end of the children speaking. I felt like everybody could have gone home. It was just priceless. You know, the things that they told us, the messages that they gave us, the feedback they gave us about how we were doing, you know, was priceless. And then from there, we just grew. And in 2021, we had 16 kids speak. And in 2023, we had 42. And this time we've got 44, I think. Yeah. So every 2 years we run it. We just ask kids now, what's important to you as a young person growing up in this world? And if you had the ear of a room full of adults who might be able to help you with something, what would you really want to tell them? What message would you want to get across? Now, when the kids come and apply to be speakers, you know, there's themes that we're picking up on. By doing, 40 kids at a time, it's like a bit of a mini representative sample. And what we're seeing is definite themes around what's happening in society at the moment and what's going on for children at the moment. In 2023, when we did it, which is not long after COVID, mental health spiked. It went from hardly registering on as an issue for children at the summit to being the number one issue. And then parental concerns also spiked. When we listened to the kids and what they were telling us is that they had heaps of time with their parents most of, during COVID, and they loved it. And then the parents went back to work again. And then they're missing their parents, you know? So that's what they were telling us. So, we get to listen to kids and their perspectives on how they're processing the changes in this world and how we are doing and what's our role as grown-ups in supporting kids with these transitions and changes and challenges. And can we actually do anything from a systemic level in our communities to support these kids with what they're processing at? The last summit, we had a young girl called Kaylee, and she gave parents a huge lecture on how much she sees them all on their screens and devices. And she goes, her title of her talk was Put Down Your Screen and Live Your Life. And she just told everybody about all the great activities that she gets to do. And she just couldn't imagine not doing those activities and having all of her time spent looking at a screen. Children tell us about all the issues that are, and this childhood summit in particular, again, we're seeing some of the social issues coming out. We've got a lot of young people really deeply concerned about the social media ban. You know, they raised that up. So many kids have raised that as an issue that we've actually put up a theme session just on social media and screens. Some kids are really, struggling with screens. We got a little fella called Mayone who's he's 10, and he's saying pretty much that he's a recovering screen addict. And he's really trying to decrease the amount of time he spends gaming. I mean, he's a really super smart kid. He gets A's and B's at school and, you know, really super lovely, but he's just not happy with how much time he's spending in front of a screen.
Well, I'm looking forward to actually experiencing my first Childhood Summit 2025, and I can't wait to meet you in person and hear more about this. But, Hayano, I think we've got much more to discover and discuss, so I hope we can stay connected.
Definitely. Yeah, and we should take up this conversation with the kids at the summit.
Well, I'd love to do that. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks. Thank you, Kim. And yeah, thanks for having me on board.
CEO of the Australian Institute of Play, Hayano Moser, sharing why shrinking children's horizons threatens their development and well-being, and why we must reimagine neighbourhoods as places where children grow happy, healthy and strong. You'll find more information about Hayano and the Australian Institute of Play, as well as the Childhood Summit 2025, in the show notes and on socials. Connect with my community via my website, where you can subscribe to my monthly newsletter, RSS feed, and mission to empower children, youth, adolescents, and parents through storytelling. Until next week, we can be the change we want to see in the world together.